Flimsy stands slowing you down? Well, it's time to upgrade. Armadillo builds durable, North American-made tablet stands and kiosks. We're so confident, we offer a lifetime warranty. So, elevate your business and visit armadillo.com. That's armodillo.com and use code ACAST for 5% off. Armadillo. Built to last. Designed to impress.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and you're very welcome to the McClifford Podcast with the Irish Examiner. Now, my guest today has been to the mountain and back in recent years in the world of politics. Regina Doherty was first elected to Dáil in 2011, held her seat in 2016, and in that year she was appointed chief whip to the Fine Gael-dominated government. The following year, Leo Varadkar appointed her as Minister for Social Protection. Then, last year now, in February 2020, she lost her seat in the general election, but stayed on government in the caretaker role until the new administration came to power. Following that, she was one of the Taoiseach's 11 nominees to the Seanad, and she is now the leader of the Seanad. In September, she announced that she was switching constituencies and hopes to run in Dublin Fingal next time around rather than Meath East, where she had previously held her seat. Regina, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much, Mick. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Now, last weekend, Regina, you were among a number of people, the first, I think, certainly from the government benches, to criticise elements of the Mother and Baby Home Commission report. Why did you come out at that stage criticising it?
I suppose it's been on our agenda for a number of years. I know Charlie Flanagan was the minister that brought forward the commission, but I used to sit beside Catherine Sapone at the cabinet table for a number of years. And when she took over as Minister for Children, obviously she was very heavily impacted and emotionally involved with the situation and the investigation, and thereafter, obviously, making sure that it was perfectly managed because of the hurt. And there's a number of other periods over the last number of years where leaks have really, really damaged and upset the survivors and indeed the children of the survivors. And I suppose the first thing that really, really annoyed me was the leaking of the report on Sunday, because I know how these things happen. I know and have been among the privileged few in the country that gets memos, and like, so you know who have access to this information. And I just thought it was such a disgusting thing to do. And the person that did it, like, normally things get leaked for personal gain. There was no gain here involved, only massive hurt. And the person that did that to me was a degenerate. Now, I know there's an investigation and all that kind of stuff going on, but my phone started kind of hopping last week. We knew it was coming. There were women that I had been, you know, helping and talking to over the last number of years. Up to high dough is probably the nicest way to put it. And I saw a gentleman tweet on Saturday evening, which prompted me then to say, I actually agreed. He had a big long thread and I agreed with a lot what was in the thread. And so then when I was asked to go on the radio on Sunday morning, I decided, I think we need to be honest about this. And it's not a criticism of government. It's not really to discount the entire report, because obviously as a historical document, it's hugely comprehensive and it's, you know, it'll be hugely valuable in the year ahead. But the language in it, some of the assertions in it, some of the opinions that have been shared, I just think are wrong. They're hurtful. I get the whole legalistic language around the report because it was judicially led. And I know, you know, that's not to be disrespectful for that, because that's what we obviously asked for. But it's certainly not what the women and the survivors were expecting. And the language in the executive summary is, in my mind, so insulting to the lived experiences of those women that came forward and shared it with us. And everything that we know that has happened, which is probably even not the real full horrors, because you know what Irish society is like. We protect and we close down and we, you know, there's family members involved and you do anything to protect them, and not even them, but to protect their granny. You know what I'm talking about. But I was really hurt on their behalf, and felt that it was time to come out and to be a voice for them, because what we'd heard up until that point was welcome, welcome, welcome. And the whole emphasis last week was the fact that we were trying, or there was a perception that we were trying to blame society and families, whereas the clear culpability for me in my mind lies with the state and with the religious institutions and with the fawning relationship that they had with each other. And that's intergenerationally. That's not to blame any particular party, because there was all of them had some aspect of control during the generations that this was involved. And so I just felt it needed to be said.
Would you have acted in the same manner if you'd still been a member of government?
Well, you see, I waited last week. I know you might think that this is easy for me to say now because the answer is yes, right? But I actually waited last week for somebody somewhere to say that this is my view and this is my feelings. And I wasn't being critical of government, because government, I know we commissioned the report and maybe it's highly unusual, but it's not unique. I mean, you only have to go to look to Alan Shatter's challenge of a particular report that was commissioned by government to know that not anybody is infallible, not even, in my view, the Pope, right? But we didn't challenge any parts of it, with the exception of Roderick coming out on Sunday saying that he absolutely disagreed with the report and that he really believed that the adoptions were forced. Nobody had challenged a single finding in the report from any level of government perspective. And yet we'd apologised and that needed to be done, and we took responsibility and that needed to be done. But nobody said, hang on a bloody second here, this is blatantly not true. To say that there was no evidence for coercion, no evidence for, you know, forced adoptions, no evidence of the women being treated any differently than they would have been treated in their home, that this was down to fathers and families without any comprehension of the grip that the church had from the pulpit on Irish society and Irish psyche, that there was a fear and a terror of, you know, reparations of anybody who didn't go along with exactly what was dictated to, not just from the church, but also from the state. Like, none of that was mentioned. And it's not fair. And what's really hugely hurtful for somebody like me who doesn't, I have no concept of what it was like, how hurtful must it have been for the women and their children to say, to hear the message that we don't believe you and it doesn't matter. And it was your own family's fault. And sure, where were the fellas? And like, that was, it was a lazy narrative and I just thought it was wrong. So,
okay. And what should be done, Regina? Because there's a problem here to some extent, and that is in the way we have run the state, certainly in recent decades, going back 3 or 4 decades, is issues arise, they're not dealt with in the usual format. We set up inquiries, we've done this time after time. Initially, it was tribunals, that was shown to be too expensive. So we invented this commission of investigation model, which to a large extent has been successful in a lot of instances. But if you have a scenario whereby a government questions or takes some action as a result of a report coming out and people not agreeing with it, I'd suggest you'd have a lot of difficulty in getting someone to conduct these kind of reports thereafter if they thought they'd be subjected to that. So what should the government do, and is that a problem?
Well, I'm not, I take your point, right? But I'm not sure I 100% agree with it, because we've had other commissions of inquiry where there have been questions arising from the commission's reports. And the authors and the writers of those reports gave press conferences, they answered questions. They were able to not explain, but put into context what their views were. We haven't got the willingness to do that this time. And so we're left with far more questions than we got answers from. We're left with fingers pointing in directions that have genuinely left people scratching their heads thinking, you know, like, it's not a big step for me to appreciate why there are women in this country who were direct subjects of mother and baby homes and county homes, wondering if the reason that the commission pointed its fingers in certain ways was to try and, you know, ameliorate the state from any culpability, or to lessen the financial burden on the religious institutions. Now, I don't believe that for a moment, but what I can't figure out is why they did what they did when the body of evidence that was presented to them, the brave 550 plus women that came forward, and you and I know that there's thousands of others who didn't, but the brave women who came forward and told their stories. First, in some instances, they were told their memories were wrong. Second of all, they were told that they weren't really, you know, like, to question the lived experiences and then to actually point fingers in areas that were not under, I suppose, review. We all know that the father scarpered in most cases, but like in some that they didn't. And we all know that families didn't keep the women at home, because if they did, we wouldn't have had the amount of thousands of women that went through them. But we all know that the society wasn't solely to blame for that, that the society had been crafted by the state's policies, which were colluded with by the church's policies and the dictation back. Like, but there was none of that context. And so, sorry, you asked me the question, what needs to be done? First of all, because there's such disappointment and hurt in the content of the commission, I really believe that we need another summary alongside the executive summary of one of the women or one of their representatives to write a nuanced, emotionally led recount of what happened, even one person to be a lived experience. And then every single lady that came forward and gave witness and testimony should be transcribed verbatim, because I don't believe Noelle is going to be the only lady that's going to have questions of the evidence that was in the report.
Noelle Brown.
Yeah, when she got her transcripts back last week. But for anybody that did come forward and give testimony, I believe that they should be transcribed verbatim and laid alongside in our archives with the Commission's report, so that history will be able to see the nuance.
And what about the members of the Commission? Should they make themselves available to an Oireachtas committee or something?
Well, I think they have been asked, but I'm told that they're not willing to, and that's fine. You know, I mean, it's not a witch hunt either. Like, they were asked to do a body of work and they produced a very, very comprehensive and albeit a hugely valuable document. And it's awful because it's probably only a small part of it that people will disagree with, and more so it's probably the opinion and, you know, the finger pointing that people disagree with, and it is at odds with the evidence that was given by the women. But what needs to me in the annals of our history is that the context of the real lived experience needs to be laid alongside this report, this historical report, and absolutely the commitments that we've given. First of all, the 22 commitments, and albeit that they're great, they need a timeline. You know, women don't expect, and you heard Brendan O'Connor opened his programme on Saturday with the expectation that government were going to screw up the redress scheme again because we've had difficulties in the past. That's an awful expectation to have, and we absolutely need to make sure that we don't, that we need to make sure that all of the commitments have a timeline so that the women can be reassured that there's a real seriousness and a determination by Roderick O'Gorman, and I really do believe there is. And for me, the most important one, I think, is the commitment to excavation, to DNA tracing, and to a fitting tribute and memorial and burial to the lives that we so undignified gave burials to in the past. And that, I use that word very loosely because in lots of cases it wasn't.
Yeah, there's a lot of dispute over that. And yeah, that is fair enough. We'll just have to see where that goes. Turning to your own career, Regina, you lost your seat in the last election.
I did.
Coming from the cabinet table, effectively, which is, I suppose, in some ways politically a huge drop. Were you fearful, or did it come as a shock to you to lose it?
I think you probably knew beforehand, to be honest with you. Like, I'm in a three-seater. There's two Fine Gaels in a three-seater. There's very, very few of them. I think I was probably the only one. There was a couple at the time, and I think everybody lost. The only surprise was in Rathdown. They gained the two Fine Gael seats because of really, really good vote management. First of all, we didn't have good vote management. That's probably very clear to say. You had two ambitious people in a constituency. There wasn't much of a team.
That was yourself and Helen McEntee.
Yeah, the current Minister for Justice. But I don't, like, that's not to shirk my own responsibility. I think the biggest mistake I made was that when I asked Leo to be the Minister for Social Protection, and he was very good enough and kind enough to allow me to do it, there were things there that I really, really wanted to do. And I threw my heart and my soul 150% into it, and probably most likely to the detriment of what, you know, gets us re-elected, which is the bread and butter constituency business. And so that's my own fault. So now I've no regrets, honest to God, like, I don't. I thoroughly enjoyed the 4 years that I was Minister for Social Protection, and genuinely felt that we got some good stuff done. So
did I see immediately after that you made some comment to the effect of, at that stage, you thought, well, that was it, I'm done with politics? Did you, initially, or was that just a kind of a shock reaction?
No, it wasn't, right? And because it wasn't really a shock, because I kind of thought, and then as the campaign was, you know, grew and Sinn Féin's, you know, boat rose much higher than maybe anybody foresaw, kind of knew that the writing was on the wall. I'm 50 next week. I thought that, you know, if you were going to do something else, that now is the time before you get too old for people to consider you to be a viable new employee. And I kind of thought that this was, You know, to be honest with you, my mind at the time, I never thought about moving constituency. My mind at the time was that it would be really difficult to win two Fine Gael seats again in a three-seater, particularly with the way politics is as polarised as it is. And Sinn Féin, you know, to their credit, have done an enormous job of winning and maintaining a particular level of support. I kind of knew that I'm not going to be able to recapture this seat. It's not that you'll, you know, have a period out and then a period back. So when Tom Curran rang and asked me to run for the Shannon, I kind of felt that, you know, it would be depriving somebody else that would have an opportunity. That feels like a lifetime ago now, to be honest with you. So then COVID happened. And then the next couple of months between February and the end of June, it felt like a whole lifetime wrapped into a couple of months with everything that needed to be done. And we did it and it was grand. But by then, I kind of was mourning the loss of, Jesus, maybe I shouldn't have made the decision so quickly. And I had started a course in DCU. I decided to kind of, you know, leave behind IT, leave behind politics, do something mad and completely different. And I had started a micro-credential course in fintech and innovation technology, just something completely different and new. But sure, I think I'd only started it about a week and a half, and then the first COVID cabinet committee took place. And sure, thereafter, we were working 15-hour days. So that had to be shelved.
And did you seek the nomination for the Shannon then?
I went and I spoke to the then Taoiseach to say that, like, I know I didn't really have any right to ask to be considered, but that I did and do genuinely feel a great grow for public representation. And I had had months, Mick, of doing clinics over Twitter, over Facebook, for helping people to get onto PUPs and to access TWSS supports, you know, all of that stuff. Normal people just not being able to get over a wall of what they saw as red tape. And the buzz you get when you help somebody just get something that they're entitled to is probably the real reason that most people get involved in politics. I mean, I know people will tell you they have lofty goals to do this and that, you know, but it's just helping normal people in your community is probably what most people start off with. And that just really rekindled my love for public service. And it was then I decided that how would I do it? How would I ask, having turned it down already, and not run? And so I got a card and I wrote a card and I asked him to say that I know I didn't have any right to ask to be considered, but that if he did form a government and he was lucky enough with the Micheál, who I knew was going to be the Taoiseach, to have nominations, that if he would consider me, I'd be grateful. So he did, and I'm here.
He didn't dare you. And it's interesting you say that thing about in a negative fashion, it's called the parish pump work, but that element of public service at the ground level, to put it that way. Because a lot of people would have perception that that is something that, as you say, people get a buzz with starting out, and that at some point it becomes just a means to an end. And then somebody like you, for instance, who make it to the cabinet, and that's the kind of system we have here, perhaps more than in other jurisdictions, where the aim is, where you can really make a difference if you make it into the cabinet. But I would have thought that somebody who has done that and been able to make a contribution at that level, like yourself, that element of the ground level work is not something that you'd relish going back to. But you're saying that during that period, it was something that you still got a buzz from.
Yeah, well, you see, I suppose there was so much distress and panic. Like, literally, I recall the first cabinet meeting, and I think we thought we had kind of, I won't say months, but definitely weeks before things accelerated. And that first cabinet meeting was when we devised the policy on illness benefit, and we had to make changes. And you couldn't, because we didn't, you know, you couldn't pass legislation. So we had to find ways to remove the waiting days. We had to find ways to increase the, like, and we did that on a Monday. That meeting happened on a Monday. And by Friday, Leo was announcing, you know, that we were literally going to have to be shutting down the country. And so we had to scramble really fast to try and devise a policy access to job seekers. And we knew job seekers at 200 and, you know, 11 euros or whatever it was at the time wasn't going to cut it. It wasn't going to stop and be sustainable for people. We also knew that we couldn't have hundreds of thousands of people arriving at Intreo offices because we couldn't have them in confined spaces or in queue. So, like, there was so much to think about. And we landed that on everybody, how to do it in the most unusual ways of, you know, sending in post, logging on, stuff that we'd never been allowed to do before. And it caused huge concern and panic for people. And people were applying on paper, and they were applying online, and they were applying by phone. And then they were given out because the following week they didn't get any money. And there was a huge amount of distress. And as anybody knows, if you live kind of week to week or month to month, if you don't have the buffer in your bank account or your post office account, well, then that level of anxiety that you live through or don't live through goes through the roof. And so I literally had my phone hopping off me, text messages, Facebook Messenger, WhatsApp, like there was, and you know, there's so many ways people can communicate with you now at this stage, like, and my DMs are open on my Twitter. And so I literally had hundreds of people. And then I had colleagues in my own parliamentary party and across the spectrum from Fianna Fáil and from other parties coming to me saying, Regina, I have this fella, I have that woman, this family, you know. So I literally had to set up clinics from my sitting room where I'm sitting right now and spend hours every single day. And I'd set up a team in the department so that I'd be able to go and say PRS number, PBS number 1234567B. They applied last Tuesday in Cork. I need to know the status of it. And literally the messages were going back and forward. And then I was getting the stories of particularly women who were trying desperately to work from home, who it wasn't cutting for their employees, and their employees were just sacking them. And because I was Minister for Employment Affairs, people were coming to me with those things, and our WRC wasn't sitting. And like, there was all of that stress was enormous. But when you helped people, and yet once we did, and the people in the Department of Social Protection are incredible, I have to be honest with you, and most of them working from home, but the level of service they gave was 200%. We did manage to help people, and it did settle down. And then the queries about backdated payments, you know, so it was constant. And then we were trying to tweak things, and we were trying to get IT systems to work because everything was done on a kind of an ad hoc. So like the work wasn't a small amount of work. It was enormous. Like, it wasn't short of anything. But I think the probably most rewarding bit of it was the helping people, the setting people up, the giving them the reassurances. And you'd go to bed knackered in the evening time, but you know you'd had looked after, you know, the couple of hundred people that have come to you through the various means that day. And that gives, that feels good. And so then that was kind of like, am I really ready to give all that up? I know it'll be a huge battle to try and win a seat, but am I really ready to give that back up? I love this job. You know, it thrills me. That's the wrong way to put it, but you know what I mean. So, and that's why I decided that I'd ask.
Stick at it. Okay. No, it's interesting you say that, because some people, Regina, as I'm sure you're aware, and I'm sure this to you in a minute, some people have this image these days of Fine Gael, that basically they're only interested in the better off. And quite obviously, most of the people you would have been dealing with in that respect, as we know during the pandemic, it's those much further down the socioeconomic ladder who've been hit far worse. That brings me to this matter, and that was a letter you wrote to the Irish Times last year. And I just say I was very taken by it, because sometimes you come across letters like this and it leaps off the page. Just point out to listeners, this was a letter in response to a column by Una Mullally, who's a columnist at the Irish Times, a very well-read columnist and somebody who has some very views that are very much, I think, chime with, definitely with some people and not with others, perhaps, which is a good sign in the columnist. Anyway, Una wrote about Fine Gael and about her view of them, and she put them very much in terms, I suppose you could say, nearly in the same boat as the Conservatives in the UK. You responded with this letter, and just taking a couple of paragraphs out of it just to give people a flavour of it. And you, the following was, I really would like to live on Una Mullally's planet, where everyone and everything is reduced to a white hat or black hat, goodies and baddies and simple answers. Of course, in her view, Fine Gael are the baddies. Ideologically cruel, our entire focus is hell-bent on targeting the welfare class. And then in brackets, her words, I don't know any Irish politician who uses such an insulting phrase. They say, of course, on planet Earth, the reality is different. I should know. I was the Fine Gael minister who introduced the pandemic payment. And just one other aspect down towards the end, because I have to say, it did leap off the page. But anyway, he said, I'm sure these facts won't dim your columnist's obsession with painting Fine Gael as the party of the privilege and private schooling. As someone who was born in Dublin's north side, grew up in a council house and never went to a boarding school, I take particular offence at such a cartoon portrayal. I can tell you that the Fine Gael party is full of very ordinary people. What unites us is not our school ties or postcodes, but our passion for everybody in Ireland to get the help and support to better lives. And on it goes in that vein. Regina, I'd have to say, despite that, the perception that Una Mullally referred to there is most definitely out there among a large cohort of the electorate.
That's why it needs to be challenged, Mick, because it's wrong. And like, it's so easy and it's so lazy to say that everybody in Fine Gael went to a private school, that everybody in Fine Gael had third level education or came from a rich farming background. And you see, the problem is that the reality is that it's not true. And so if you don't challenge a lazy narrative, and as you know, in the world of disinformation that we're all living in at the moment, if you don't challenge it, the thing that gets said the most becomes the mantra and it becomes reality. And it isn't reality. The vast majority of people in Fine Gael are from normal backgrounds. I think we've started this programme off talking about the fact that I grew up in North County Dublin. My father is from Clarne in the Boot Inn. My mother is from Finglas. Both of them worked every single day in their life to ensure, and I was an only child till I was 11, and nearly 12 when my brother was born. They worked every day, my dad in DSB as a driver and my mother in a school canteen in Blanchardstown, to make sure that we didn't go without. But I know they did go without. Now, that's the reality for me. I didn't have the privilege of a third level education when I was 18. Okay, I've gone back since and I've done it then, but it's only because I worked and I'd be able to, you know. So not everybody in Fine Gael is this stereotyped, you know, school going, tie wearing club that Una Mullally and others like her would have you believe. The vast majority of the farmers that are in Fine Gael don't have huge wealth, and they bloody well have to work hard for the small holdings that they have or for the small dairy herd that they have. So, like, these are normal people who work hard for a living, and in the main are probably the people that actually give the most and get nothing back from the state, to be fair. But anyway, that's another day's work. So,
yeah, and that's fair enough. However, there's another element to it, and that is... the last election, for instance. Now, I think there's I've heard someone referencing to it. You know, this book comes out after every election, How Ireland Votes. I think it's been delayed this time because of the pandemic. Yeah. But as I understand it, that will show research that suggests that largely in the last election, people voted to a large extent according to income and whether or not they felt they were better or worse off in the previous year or so under the current government. And to some extent, that is along socioeconomic lines. Those that were better off perhaps did all right. Those who weren't didn't. And that would certainly feed into a narrative that Fine Gael's base, those to whom they would be most wedded, would be those who the better off section of society.
Well, I'm not sure I agree. And I will look forward to reading the report when it does come out. But I think you and I both know that the swing voters, those people who make up their minds in the last couple of weeks, are the people who decide what shape a government is. And the vast majority of those swing voters moved to Sinn Féin because of an enormous momentum that built up around not just one issue, but a number of issues. And yes, of course, there was dissatisfaction with Fine Gael at the time. Nothing was perfect, but an awful lot had been achieved. And I'll have to be honest with you, we're not very good at telling you, even though we get labelled with, you know, the whole spin thing, we're not very good at telling you of all of the good things that we've done. Because even though it's nearly a year later since the election, I'm still the person that apparently is getting blamed for cutting people's pension, even though I increased it 3 times for the 3 years that I was there. I'm the person that's apparently being blamed for people having to work for below minimum wage because I introduced community employment. And yet I was 12 when community employment, you know, so these narratives, you know, exist in urban legends and they suddenly grow arms and legs. Whereas I would have to tell you, Mick, there's not probably very many people that would be able to rhyme off the fact that I banned 0-hour contracts. I'm the first person that brought the minimum wage to the second highest level in the European Union. I introduced job seekers benefit for the self-employed. Every single taxi man, hairdresser, plumber, you know, all of those people who lost their jobs last March that were self-employed. If I hadn't have brought in that legislation the year before, not one of them would have got the PUP. And imagine the kind of hole we would have been in then, you know what I mean? I introduced paid parental leave. There was a load of stuff that I got done for the couple of years that I was there. Does anybody know that? No, but everybody knows that I cut the pension even though I didn't. You know what I mean? So,
Well, one other element to it, and probably the biggest issue at the time, and probably in terms of bread and butter issues, probably the biggest issue in general is housing. And yet, Fine Gael have been the one constant over the last 10 years when the housing crisis has reached crisis point and still is there. And again, in terms of housing, and I don't just mean homelessness in terms of people in emergency accommodation or those rough sleeping, but people who can't literally afford to buy a house, particularly the younger generation. Again, they are the ones who will have suffered most under 9 years of Fine Gael governments as a result.
But again, and I don't mean to be disrespectful to you, you know, first of all, for the first 5 years, there wasn't a single penny to, you know, to spend and invest in doing anything, because every morsel of time for the people, God love them, who were at that cabinet, and some of them suffered because of it too, was trying to cut a cloth based on the amount of money that they had left, which wasn't determined by a growing economy. It was determined by an absolutely savaged economy based on a massive recession because of mismanagement. It doesn't matter why it happened, right? But you know that you had departments of social welfare, even though the numbers in unemployment went through the roof between the years of 2008 and 2015, and the overall budget did have to increase. 4 billion euros had to be taken off the most vulnerable in this country because of the state of the economy. There was no money to spend building houses. And we also know our local authorities had been disincentivized probably for the previous 20 years to not bother building anymore, to sell it to the private market. When Owen Murphy, and God bless him, worked the rounds of the clock to build the building blocks for what we have, and I know it's been interrupted by COVID, when he started rebuilding Ireland, which Simon Coveney had started it the year before he took over, it was never going to work fast enough to live up to people's expectations. But it will work. Now, OK, if it hadn't been interrupted by COVID, we might be seeing the benefits of more houses last year and this year. And obviously construction has been damaged seriously again because of this lack of access to sites and stuff like that. But the money is now there. But the reason the money is there and the plans are good is because we had a jobs-led economy recovery and growth that was probably unprecedented and never seen before in Ireland, which we were just bloody lucky. Now, I know there's people that will tell you that we planned it that way. To a certain extent, some of the policies were, but we did get lucky. And now we have the money to be able to spend. And yes, some of the policies still aren't ready. But you were never going to fix every ill from 2016 after that election, where we lost massive numbers of seats again, as you know, because people weren't satisfied with the previous 5 years. It was only starting then. That's only a short 5 years ago. So we went from building no houses to at least to 2020, when we were building near 25,000. Now, that's a massive increase for an industry that was on its knees and didn't have any, you know, workers, yeah, let alone any investment in it. So
I think some people might dispute the figures in terms of building 25,000, but there certainly no one became available. But I take your point. There was a narrative there, and that is disputed and continue to be disputed. But in more general terms, Regina, what the election does suggest is that the country appears to be moving towards a traditional left-right, and as people would probably say, right of centre, left of centre, because I don't think either are any extreme model now. Do you think that's a positive thing?
I think if it was real, it would be a positive thing. But you see, I don't think it is real. So I think, like, you know, there are a lot of centrist parties, what used to be the two traditional parties, and we would be classified as centre-right. Fianna Fáil would have classified themselves as centre-left. Do you know what? They're not. Both of them are centrist parties, and that's the end of it, because there is very little difference if you get outside of the nuance of the policies and the objections that they have for the society and the country and the economy that we live in. What you have is a really false narrative of a party that's pretending to be on the left, and they're not. And so
are you
real
about
left,
Sinn Féin?
And I'm talking about Sinn Féin. Now, that's just populism, and that's fine, and maybe that's what will get them into power, and then we'll really see what their true colours are.
Well, there's
the
such a thing as left
are
populism.
The are the people before profit, our solidarity, to a certain extent, you know, the Labour Party, and some of our very, very left-leaning independents. They have nothing in common with Sinn Féin policy. And so, like, I will be very interested, I have no doubt.
Well, to be fair now, the likes of the Labour Party, for instance, Social Democrats would describe themselves as left, and I don't think many people would dispute that.
No.
And Sinn Féin would suggest themselves, and I think others observing would suggest, to put it this way perhaps, they're at least as left as that, if not more so, and that they are the leading party if there is to be that traditional ideological divide.
I don't agree with that. And I tell you, like, and my opinion probably doesn't stand for much, but I have no doubt that in the next number of years, and probably sooner maybe than a lot of us expect, Sinn Féin will be in government. And then we'll get to see the real true colours of their policies. And the phrase, I think it was Rory Quinn or Pat Rabbit, I can't remember which one of them, said that we all election in poetry and we govern in prose. Well, it'll be very, very interesting to see what the colour of Sinn Féin's prose is, if and when they do get in, because their track record in local government for the councils that they do have, and I'm not even going to go near Northern Ireland because it's a whole different set of structures and I think everybody knows that, but their track record in local government is appalling. And so if that's anything to instill inspiration for people as to how they'll act on a national level, it doesn't really. But look, you know what? I've no doubt it will come. I've no doubt that there is a real disillusionment in Irish politics. And unless something drastically changes over the next number of years, I think Sinn Féin will get their opportunity to be in power and we'll see what, you know, what the colour of their policies are then.
Finally, Regina, just in terms of the old chestnut, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, will they merge? Do you see them merging within your term of politics and hopefully of a long term coming?
I don't. Thank you very much. I don't. And it's not because, you know, there are incredibly decent people in Fianna Fáil. And the more time you spend with people, the more you know how decent they are. But what's really weird, and it's deep rooted and ingrained, is that even though we are in a cooperation and a coalition with each other, it takes the slightest little thing for that 100-year-old division and rivalry to come straight back up. And, you know, like, I grew up in a household where Fianna Fáil were bad, Fine Gael were good. I know others who grew up in the Fianna Fáil good household. You know, I married into a Fianna Fáil household and they're funny. It took me years to convert them. It doesn't take an awful lot for that vitriol, guttural, emotional response to come
back. But
it's based on nonsense.
A dispute 100 years ago that lasted for a very, very brief period.
Yeah, honestly, God, you're dead right. It is based on nonsense, but it's instinctful in us. I don't know whether my mother or father, you know, droned me on it when I was a kid. But it's not just unique to me. It's all of us. And it's not even the older generations. Like, my daddy is 86 this year, and I'm a lot younger than he is. And I would be more tolerant, but there is a level where you kind of think, hold on, a bloody, you know. So I think, and I also don't think it would be healthy for Irish politics either, to be very honest with you, because I think it's good to have choice. I think what will happen in the next number of years is that the old traditional of big party and smaller party going into coalition are long gone. We've seen it happen right across Europe with multiple party coalitions. And I actually think that's much healthier. What we have to manage in Ireland is to develop the relationships to allow that to be sustainable. Because I think, and it's, you can see it in other European countries too, and the advent of the Italian government just fallen in the last number of weeks, when parties and coalitions stay in their own silos and don't cross-party develop relations, well, then that doesn't ever have an opportunity to give you longevity. I think if we can cross that Rubicon, then I think we can have a really successful coalitions going forward in the for my kids and your kids and their grandkids and stuff in the future. But I think it is possible for us to have smaller parties and more of them and more balance. And I think we'd get a better outcome for the country if we could just cooperate with each other. So
we'll see. We'll see how that goes. Regina Doherty, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's it, folks. Thank you for listening. I want to thank JJ Vernon, our engineer. You can get the podcast on the usual platforms, or please give me a shout anytime about what you think about it at mick.clifford@examiner.ie or on Twitter at @mickcliff. See you soon.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.